projects, of ideas, open questions related to how we understand dark matter halos, and specifically dark matter halos in the full, as a full phase space system. Some of the work that I'll describe is fairly recent, and that will be work mainly done by Pascal Elahi, who is a graduate student at Queen's and worked with me and Rob Thacker, who's recently moved from Queen's to St. Mary's. Some of it goes back a bit. In particular, I'll describe some work that I did with David Stiff, who was a graduate student at Queen's about 10 years ago. It's an idea we had in trying to understand the phase space structure of dark matter halos, and this was a chance to revisit that. My interest in this subject is twofold. One is as a pure theoretical problem, how do we understand the structure of dark matter halos, at least as we see them in simulations? And second, what are the implications of the structure, the phase space structure of dark matter halos for dark matter detection experiments? So the formation of dark matter halos within the context of the standard cold dark matter paradigm is a relatively clean physics problem. The system that we're trying to understand is quite simple. We have collisionless particles, particles that interact with the mean gravitational field of all of the other particles. We can ignore particle-particle interactions and no other interactions other than essentially Newtonian gravity. The initial conditions are also fairly simple. Initially, in the standard CDM paradigm, dark matter particles have negligible velocity dispersion. The density distribution of the dark matter is roughly constant, but there are linear random perturbations, and we believe that we can calculate the power spectrum of these perturbations from fundamental physics, a theory such as inflation. The phenomenology that we get out of the simulations also suggests that the physics of how dark matter halos form in this model is relatively simple, and we should be able to understand this in a theoretical sense. We have, perhaps most famously, the spherically average density profiles of dark matter halos. Here I'm plotting r squared rho. And we find that all sorts of dark halos over a wide range of mass scales can be fit by simple analytic functions, Navarro, Frank, and White, or Ernesto profiles, and improve the resolution. That's what this figure from a recent paper by Navarro is attempting to show. And again, these simple few-parameter analytic functions do a good job of representing the spherically average profiles. We can also study the subhalo mass function, and so in the background is a simulation of a Milky Way-sized halo, and we can quantify how much mass there is in all of this substructure. We can put the substructure into subhalo mass bins and then count up the mass in each of those bins. This is the subhalo mass function, and the fact that this function, as we go to smaller and smaller subhalo masses, is relatively flat tells us that the mass in each logarithmic subhalo mass bin is roughly constant. And so there could be quite a lot of mass locked up in all of this substructure. There's all sorts of other interesting properties that have been studied in dark matter halos. Halos are not spherical, but tend to be triaxial. They show velocity anisotropy, so the velocity structure. Yeah?
Spherical average profile. So I want to get a sense of what you think and maybe others. Is NFW now a thing of the history, or can maybe I still use it? Or NFW?
I guess it depends on what you're really interested in. If you're interested in what's going on very deep inside the halos, then it seems like an OSCO gives a better fit. You're interested probably in rotation curves, then either is going to work, unless you really want to know what's going on in the core.
And so it seems like the annihilation signal actually don't depend that much on it, at least for like a non-velocity dependent.
And what goes on in the center of big galaxies is so much driven by adiabatic contraction and the baryons and all of that.
So is it clear that the slope is becoming flatter than...
That's what it appears. It appears that the slope is running. Looking for the cusp strength was the wrong way to go. They're trying to measure the power law slope in the core wasn't the right thing to do because the power law slope is running. So So we have other things like the pseudo phase space profile. These halos are rotating, and when the substructure gets tidally disrupted, it's going to produce streams of dark matter. We should try and see if you understand that. There are also hints of some self-similarity between halos. This is a famous, now somewhat old picture by Ben Moore's group, showing a cluster-sized halo and a galaxy-sized halo, and essentially showing that dark matter halos from different that are generated from different parts of the CDM power spectrum look more or less the same. So they have the same random number seeds for the perturbations, but have different slopes of the power spectrum. So what is our ultimate goal as dark matter theorists? Theorists who study dark matter, not theorists who are made of dark matter, I guess. It's to develop a generative theoretical or at least phenomenological model for dark matter halos. That is, if we really understand dark matter halos, we should come up with a simple set of instructions such that we could build a synthetic halo that would be indistinguishable from halos found in simulations. And if we really trust the model, then perhaps we can push beyond the resolution limits of present-day simulations. And so I think that's the ultimate goal, at least for the theorists who study this, and quite a large number of people at this meeting have thought about this issue. In short, what we aim to do is find the phase space distribution function that describes a dark matter halo. Maybe I'll switch to this. A distribution function in position and velocity. This is interesting both theoretically, but also all dark matter detection experiments, direct or indirect, probe this distribution function. So anything that you wish to calculate for your detector will in some way involve an integral over the phase-based distribution function and something which accounts for the response of the detector to the dark matter particles. So in this conference, we'll focus quite a bit on direct detection experiments where a WIMP comes in, scatters off of some nucleon in the detector. Nuclei carries off some recoil energy Q at some angle phi, and the WIMP scatters at some angle theta. We don't care about those angles, and so we end up integrating over the scattering angle. That's essentially what this integral of the speed distribution does. But in the end, we get a recoil spectrum, a rate as a function of the recoil energy of the detector nucleus. If all WIMPs had the same speed, if we had a delta function in the speed distribution, then we'd get something like a step function in the recoil energy spectrum, perhaps modified by the detector function, the function of recoil energy. The standard model, the model that people use to make the mass cross-section plots, assumes a Maxwellian distribution for the speed distribution of particles or velocity distribution of particles in the neighborhood of our detector. We, because we're moving around the center of the galaxy at 200 kilometers per second, sit off-center in this Maxwellian. And because we ride on the Earth, which goes around the sun, we actually move along that blue circle in velocity space once every year. And so the speed distribution shifts with the seasons, and thus the recoil spectrum shifts with the seasons, and that's the seasonal modulation that we've already heard about. And then we use this type of model and our model of our detectors to generate plots like this, and we'll see many, many examples of this plot over the course of the workshop. Now, a baby step toward a generative model is to take the spherically averaged density profile, assume isotropic velocities, and calculate a distribution function which depends only on the energy of the WIMP particles. This is a standard exercise which you can carry out using formula from Binney and Tremaine. It's a generative model for the dark matter particle distribution function. But of course, it doesn't capture any of the real physics of dark matter halos, triaxiality, rotation, and so forth and so on. You could try to improve things by considering distribution functions which depend on the energy and the angular momentum about some symmetry axis and produce flattened and rotating halos. You can introduce velocity anisotropy and use the energy and the total angular momentum. If you want to do both, and produce something that looks a bit more realistic, then you clearly need three integral distribution functions, and that's where things get really scary. And also, we're not modeling the substructure. And so things get complicated quite rapidly. Let me describe some challenges for the simulations. And the most obvious one is the limited resolution that we have. Even though dark matter halos in our simulations today have of order a billion particles, or a mass resolution of about 10 to the 3 solar masses, even though this means that the simulations are essentially collisionless, which is what we want, in typical WIMP models, the first objects that form have a mass of roughly the mass of the Earth, and so we're 9 or more orders of magnitude short of doing realistic simulations for a Milky Way-sized halo. And we should think about whether this is a real problem. Again, here's a sort of different view of the subhalo mass function. We're counting the number of subhalos as a function of halo mass fraction, reasonably well fit by a power law. And so one might imagine modeling the subhalo mass function as a power law function of subhalo mass. But if we really want to understand all of the substructure in the CDM hierarchy, then we have to extrapolate about 12 orders of magnitude up in this plot. And that's sort of a scary proposition. Yeah.
Talk about the beams when they say this, like, what is the cutoff? Is it 12 orders of magnitude or 9 orders of magnitude? But what if it's axions? Do you know where the cutoff is?
Axions. It's like not offhand.
So it's an extra 10 orders.
An extra 10
axions are even colder.
Yeah. So it's much worse. So then you worry about all these caustics and things that Piresi-Keeby worries
about.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I don't think that makes much of a difference, but okay.
And then I'll talk a little bit about the Sakini stuff in a bit. There's a further challenge here, and that is that the behavior of the CDM power spectrum at very small scales is pathological.
For the first objects in the CDM hierarchy that form, there's a collapse over a wide range of scales that happens nearly simultaneously. As we think of hierarchical clustering, as small-scale objects collapse first, and merge to form systems of larger and larger size. But as I'll describe in a moment, at very small scales, everything's collapsing simultaneously, and so it's difficult to do simulations with any sort of dynamic range. I can mention that almost anything else that you would think of throwing at it from the lore of structure formation, how we understand structure formation, also fails. So perturbation theory, second-order perturbation theory, renormalization group methods, all these things, I think, have problems as you go to very small scales. So we can remind ourselves of how this goes. We imagine that in the early universe, we have a box where the density distribution of dark matter is relatively uniform with small-scale perturbations, which then grow through gravitational instability to form our dark halos. The initial conditions, we have mass fluctuations associated with different scales, described by the inverse wave number. We can calculate a power spectrum for those density perturbations. And if we take k cubed times that power spectrum, we get something which tells us roughly the power per logarithmic bin in wave number. So that's, I think, the most physically relevant quantity for thinking about the power spectrum. So this is generally, a primordial power spectrum times a transfer function, which describes the physics of how modes evolve from outside the horizon to inside the horizon. This takes us from inflation to the point where structure formation begins. And over any small range in K, we can always write this as some power law function of K with some effective index N, which has to do, again, with the primordial power spectrum and the transfer function. And so for k goes to infinity, that is for very, very small scales, n effective is approaching minus 3. And you can sort of work out how that dependence goes. And so for n goes to minus 3, delta squared is roughly constant. And that's the indication that things are collapsing nearly simultaneously. Well, as part of his thesis, Pascal and Rob Thacker looked at scale-free simulations, so simulations in which the power spectrum was a pure power law function of K. This is nice because you can actually check the physics, the numerics, if the power spectrum is scale-free initially, then there should be some scaling relations in the nonlinear power spectrum. So you can really check whether you're doing things properly or whether numerical effects are creeping in. From the old Moore et al. Paper, the clusters that they were looking at corresponded to roughly an effect of n of minus 1.8, whereas the galaxy scale halos had an effect of n of minus 2.2. So not all that different. And so maybe it's not surprising that they look so similar. But we wanted to explore a wider range in n, and so considered an n equal minus 1 pure scale-free universe and an n equal minus 2.5 scale-free universe, and found that there were noticeable differences. The substructure is more washed out with the steeper power spectrum, with the power spectrum closer to n of minus 3. This is the subgalactic scale, and this may be something like a supercluster scale or larger.
These are both meant to be, yeah, roughly the virial radian.
What's plotted below?
And what's plotted below are actually subhalos found by some 16 friends of friends out there.
Okay, there was an interesting paper that predates ours in which by Diamond Kulin, who is here, and Pierre Madau, in which they attempt to simulate microhalos. They actually attempt to go right to the bottom of the CDM hierarchy, where cold dark matter is actually at least a little bit hot or warm, and find structure that looks more like hot dark matter, not surprisingly, and see if they can understand what the very first objects are at the bottom of the CDM hierarchy. They, of course, realize that they have this problem. The effective index of the power spectrum is minus 3. And scales are collapsing nearly simultaneously. And in fact, if you think about this problem, and this was something worked out in a paper by Smith et al., and we did as well, and asked how many particles do you need to properly do a simulation with a given spectral index, it blows up, and it blows up in a sort of super exponential way. So the number of particles that you need goes as 1 over, as something to the power 1 over n plus 3. And so as n goes to minus 3, the index is becoming infinite. And so if you really want to do those first objects, then you should be using something like 10 to the 20 particles or so forth. So what it says is our simulations and those of Diamond et al. Should be taken with a grain of salt. This is really a difficult, challenging numerical problem. And one that we should think long and hard about. Why is this important? Well, substructure can enhance the signal from indirect detection experiments. We've already seen the boost factor that comes into these types of calculations in an earlier talk. This is annihilation probes the line of sight integral of the density squared, and so that's why clumpiness can enhance this signal. Because if you move matter around and make it more clumpy, then you enhance the annihilation signal. This is line of sight integrals through a dark matter simulation, and it suggests that these annihilation signals should be clumped both toward the galactic center and towards various substructure which might exist. This is a rather messy plot, something you would only assigned to a graduate student, I think. Pascal actually looked at 21 different simulations that studied the subhalo mass function and attempted to plot the index of the subhalo mass function that they found and also the normalization factor as a function of the effective n. And you can see that it's quite a bit of a scatter plot with a broad range in indices. And since we're attempting to extrapolate the subhalo mass function by 12 orders of magnitude, then this index really counts. Small changes in the index really do matter. And so it's sort of interesting to see the state of the simulations and trying to understand the subhalo mass function. F is the mass fraction of the subhalos. So take a parent halo of a given mass, and plot the subhalo mass function, fit it by this simple power law, and then plot your results as a function of the parent halo mass. And then we went ahead and calculated boost factors, but here used relatively what we thought were more realistic extrapolations of the subhalo mass function, and we found more modest boost factors. So we found boost factors that went up maybe if you push things up to 30 or so, but not the boost factors of 1,000 or so that you might see in other models. Again, this is just the geometric clumping of dark matter boost factors. Okay, let me go on to a different issue, which has to do with another challenge for simulations, that is, to what extent simulations properly obey Liouville's theorem and follow the phase-phase sheet of dark matter. So just a general introduction, for collisionless systems, the phase-phase density along a particle's orbit is constant. And here's a toy model which has absolutely nothing to do with gravity, let alone dark halo. But we just have some set of points in phase space, a two-dimensional phase space, that are evolving according to some simple dynamical equations. The phase space structure gets wound up into this tight spiral, but nevertheless, the phase space density for any particle remains the same throughout the evolution. And so if you start with a particle here, it ends up someplace in this spiral, but if that particle looks at the local phase space density, it's the same as it was when the particle started. Moreover, the system is fully reversible. That is, I can unwind this phase-phase structure if I reverse the dynamics. And so it's phase mixing, but there's no real relaxation of the system. Pierre Sakivi and Jim Ipser thought about this issue in the context of dark halos. Because dark matter halos start off with initially zero velocity dispersion, they lie on a three-dimensional phase-space sheet, which gets wrapped up and curled up through the action of gravity. But if all we have is phase mixing, then we should still have evidence of this phase-space sheet. And so they thought about the implications of this, in particular for axion detection. So here's another baby step toward a theoretical model for a dark matter halo. It's a beautiful solution by Fillmore and Goldreich and Birchinger from the 80s, a self-similar solution for a spherical collapse model. So in this model, I'm plotting radius versus radial velocity. Every point in this graph corresponds to a shell, a spherical shell with a particular radius and a particular radial velocity. Here are the particles that are still expanding as part of the Hubble flow. Here's the shell that's just turned around. These are the shells that are falling in for the first time. They pass through the center, they come back out, pass through the center, and come back out again. And eventually you have a structure that has roughly a power law density profile, but with sharp peaks due to these caustics that arise in the distribution. You could imagine putting a dark matter detector, sorry for the yellow here, so that's radius again and radial velocity, you can put a dark matter detector down. That's a dark matter detector that can detect any velocity at a particular radius, and the dark matter detector would then see peaks at different velocities corresponding to the different streams, and so the speed distribution would look something like this, a series of peaks. And this is what Sakivian collaborators have thought about in the context, again, of axion detection. For WIMPs, then, you have something like a series of steps in recoil energy. An interesting idea.
Discrete.
Why is the speed distribution discrete? Essentially because at any particular radius, you have either shells falling in for the first time, the second time, or the third time, and those have a particular velocity, at least in the context of the spherical infall model. So this describes what I'm showing here is the full phase-space distribution function. And at any particular radius, we have only discrete velocity. So the shells are all moving through each other, but they're not continuously distributed in velocity, only discrete stream in velocity space.
Okay.
Well, Fillmore and Goldwright describe smooth spherical infall with an initial perturbation that's monotonic in R. Our view was that one shouldn't take this too seriously, at least as a model for dark halo. Again, it's a baby step toward a realistic halo. In the standard model, structure formation proceeds on all scales, and perturbations exist in some hierarchical way. So here's a toy model to show this. I don't know how to visualize three-dimensional sheets in six dimensions, but I can do a planar collapse. And so here's a single mode in a plane symmetric universe. Planar collapse is nice because you can calculate the force by just adding up the particles to the right and subtracting the particles to the left. So it's all quite analytic. And you get this nice phase-space structure. So again, velocity versus position. But if you put in a one-dimensional spectrum of modes with more power at small scales, then you have these little swirls forming at small scale, and then the little swirls merge with larger swirls, and you end up with something which sort of looks more like a one-dimensional one-dimensional halo with structure, substructure, and so forth and so on. And then if you imagine your dark matter detector sitting at a particular position in this halo, then you would see a series of peaks and subpeaks in a complicated velocity structure. You wouldn't be able to predict where the peaks were, as in the spherical infall model, but velocity space would be rather peaked and complicated. And so the ideal terrestrial detector, the way we should think of at least an ideal detector, is that it's a three-dimensional plane, fixed position and with full velocity space coverage. And a theorist detector would be able to get the full velocity space and not just the recoil energy spectrum, which cuts out most of the information. If the distribution function is a three-dimensional surface, albeit curled up on all these scales, then F of V will be a collection of peaks and subpeaks. And so that's perhaps the way we should be thinking about distribution functions in velocity space. So there are two interesting questions to ask. One is, do n-body simulations correctly evolve the phase-space sheet? And second, if they did, can we properly visualize and study it? So is the phase-space sheet there, and how do we really see the phase-space sheet? Again, visualization of a three-dimensional sheet, very complicated in six dimensions, is difficult to visualize. So there's an interesting sort of two issues. Well, let me go back to sort of more general question, which is how we might use simulations to characterize the velocity distribution of dark matter at a particular position within a dark halo where our detector might sit. And a standard way of doing this is to pick some region in the simulation and then calculate the speed or velocity distribution and use that to compute a recoil energy spectrum. So that's one way of asking, what do the simulations tell terrestrial dark matter detection folks? There's an uncertainty principle that that works here, which says that if you want better velocity resolution, choose a bigger box and you get more particles and you can get a better resolution of the velocity space structure. But then you lose on spatial resolution and you start to wash out structure because you're probing a larger area of your simulation. So that's the trade-off that has to work there. David Stiff and I years ago had a following scheme, which was an attempt to look for the phase space structure, as in the structure of this three-dimensional sheet in six-dimensional phase space. And the idea is as follows. Imagine you do this simulation with very poor resolution. So this is this one-dimensional curling up of the phase space structure. In the final frame of the system, lay down a set of test particles where your detector is. Those particles all have the same position but are spread out in velocity space. Evolve the whole system backward in time to the initial time step where dark matter is essentially at zero velocity. So these particles unwind themselves. And then your detector test particles end up in this curled phase space structure. Look for the points where the detector particles are close to the line V equals zero, and those correspond to the points in velocity space where the detector is going to detect real particles. Those are the peaks in the velocity space distribution. And then do some iteration and refine where you put your test particle. So in this way, you get better resolution, but just at the position of the detector. So that's how we boost the resolution of the simulation. And so we tried this in the simple spherical shell case, where we run a sort of Fillmore and Goldwright type simulation. We lay down our test particles. If you have lousy resolution, then you get a very poor description of the phase space structure. But if you use this reverse run method, then you actually pick out all of the peaks very nicely. So it seems to pick out the phase space structure, even if you don't have enough resolution to do so using the standard techniques. The problem in all this is that n-body simulations generally are not reversible, and Liouville's theorem is not satisfied in any realistic n-body simulation. Our fix, and this is sort of where we gave up on this idea, was to use an extra large softening length. And I can say a little bit more about that in a moment. Well, maybe I'll say something. Well, let me skip that since I'm running just a little bit short on time. Recently, Fantin, Merrifield, and Green, though, I think have gone back to this idea and tried a simpler problem. They've attempted to study the tidal disruption of a single satellite or subhalo in a fixed potential. They chose a potential which may not be the most realistic, but has some very nice properties when you think of orbits in angle action space. The dynamics becomes almost trivial in this case. And what they do is lay down particles where the detector is, evolve them backward in time in this fixed potential, and ask which particles end up in the phase space distribution function of the satellite. And then those pick out the particles with the right velocity that ends up where the detector is. And so they're able to study the speed distribution due to a satellite that's tidally disrupted in this particular model. And this is, I think, a beautiful picture which shows speed and also one of the angles of the velocity, the angle relative to the I think direction of motion of the satellite orbit itself. And you see all sorts of structure in space. So if you could build a detector that would measure the energy distribution and one of the angles with very high precision, then perhaps this is what you would see. No. No, so I think they have to ignore all sorts of physics to do this. But they just wanted sort of the simplest way of doing orbits, which is angle action in this very special type of potential.
Why is that? It's basically inducing mass, then some of these structures are washed away.
Yeah, and in fact, the previous plot looks at sort of the issue of how you change the velocity dispersion of the satellite and sort of explores that effect. Well, let me say that these ideas suggest that it may be possible at least to come up with some phenomenological model for the local speed distribution. And you might imagine that locally, the velocity space distribution of dark matter is composed of some set of streams. In a sense, everything should be in streams at some level. The key question is how many streams are there and what is their distribution? What is the internal dispersion of each of the streams? Do the streams have substructure? What's the mass distribution in each of the streams?
This is a tough problem, something that Helmy and White had thought about a good number of years ago, and Mark Vogelsberger as well, who's here. But anyway, if you take this phenomenological model, imagine that velocity space looks like some distribution of streams, calculate the speed distribution function, calculate the recoil spectrum, you get something which may look roughly like what you would expect from the Maxwellian model, except that there are these small little steps which correspond to the streams at high velocity. And so it's the ones way out on the tail of the Maxwellian that are going to be, I think, the most interesting. And once the dark matter detection people can agree that they've detected dark matter and can go after things like the energy distribution or the recoil spectrum in great detail and perhaps get some directional information, then we can begin to do dark matter astrophysics. Okay, so maybe I probably have just a minute or two. So one of the further challenges is how we identify substructure, and there's a long list. I'm sure I'm missing some of methods on how to detect halos and subhalos. We have our own addition to this subfield of how we find peaks and substructure. And the basic idea is to look for peaks above the Maxwellian sea. That is, in any dark matter halo, most of the particles can be well described by this Maxwellian, but occasionally you have streams and substructure that pass through. And so the idea is to look in little local regions of a dark halo, try to characterize the background by some Maxwellian, then calculate the velocity space density of the particles. But instead of making a cut in the phase space distribution function or in the velocity space distribution, divide out by the background, which we've calculated with great care, and then it's the peaks that sit above the Maxwellian that rise up. And so it's a way of highlighting substructure, especially the substructure that sits out on the tail of the Maxwellian, which is the one that's most interesting for dark matter detection experiments. For the most part, haven't thought. So we're simply identifying structures. And in fact, we're interested in streams. And so everything has, nothing's bound. We're just interested in characterizing substructure in the halo and not worrying about whether it's bound objects or not.
DirectOff does not have a cutoff for the escape velocity.
Not in this case, but we could try. So it's a Maxwellian. Well, it's tri-Maxwellian, so it's got some anisotropy to it. We haven't tried anything beyond a Maxwellian, but we should probably think about some modified Maxwellian that would better match the background.
So when you say peaks, do you mean peaks in six dimensions or in three dimensions?
Well, since we're looking in some local volume, we'll assume that the background density is roughly constant. And so the six-dimensional phase space is proportional to the three-dimensional velocity space density. So it's the idea of just splitting space and space and velocity densities.
Okay, so it's peaks in three dimensions.
So it's peaks in three-dimensional velocity space.
Because the peaks in six dimensions would be stopped by those peaks in three dimensions would be streams. And you're talking about streams, not something.
Right, but I guess because we're looking at some small volume, we're essentially assuming the density is constant. When we come to identifying individual streams, then we look at the spatial orientation of different particles. So we start to look at whether these particles are related in physical space as well as velocity space. So that's the basic idea. As a supervisor would think of it, and this is sort of the idea as a graduate student would think about it. So again, sort of splitting up the halo into cells, characterizing the background, finding this ratio of the background to the local velocity space density to the background density and so forth and so on. So I'll just end with this movie of a subhalo that's being disrupted in a background halo. Here we're just plotting the physical density, the phase space density, and here we're highlighting this ratio, which nicely follows sort of all the particles that have been stripped off from the halo. I'll leave it there. Stop. Yes?
There seems to be a lot of news coming out from Europe about the fact, even from Carlos Frink at Durham, at a recent meeting in the Mitton Observatory in Paris, that cold dark matter isn't working that well, particularly below 200 kiloparsecs. And they're moving towards warm dark matter with KeV. Now, what is your opinion about this? There's too much substructure predicted cusps to all of these problems.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this problem has come and gone many times over the years. I suppose when you really try to look at what's going on small scales, both with substructure and with cusps, there's an additional complication of what the baryons are doing to the dark matter. Things get much more complicated. So
in the center of a big galaxy like ours, it's really baryon dominated. The inflow of baryons is going to affect the dark matter. It's not obvious how that works as an adiabatic contraction, adiabatic expansion, and so forth. And the same thing with substructure, which can be affected by an early generation of stars with blowout mass and so forth. So, if someone wants to push the idea of warm dark matter, that's great, because Scott Dobleson and I have a warm dark matter candidate for you, but I'm not sure CDM is really...
How does the warm dark matter fit in with concordance? Acoustical power spectrum, matter power spectrum fits. Do you still get the same prediction for the first peak, et cetera, et cetera?
I think the first peak is okay. Beyond that, there must be more experts in the room on, as you crank up things like neutrino masses and so forth, you start to change the peak structure.
It's pretty hard to see. It's like the fifth peak or something. It's like way down the tail. It's hard to distinguish it with the CMB.
If I know before, this is probably better.
I'm not sure. Sure.
There's also complaints about dwarf galaxies, which are always the bugaboo, because they're dominated by dark matter. And the latest results from Durham claim that the formation structure of these things is not working properly. They're too low in density, etc. Other complaints.
Yeah. I mean, again, you get into all sorts of problems of how feedback works and the first stars and the baryon. So it's sort of a bit outside of my expertise, but my sense is that it's tough to kill off dark matter with these types of observations, rotation curves of dwarf galaxies and so forth, so you really understand what the baryons are doing.
Well, what observations do kill it off?
Well, maybe we should move on. It is?
I just wanted to comment. A lot of what we've been talking about so far and what Larry's been talking about is sort of in the context of CDM, where things go, there are structures that go down in very, very, very small scales, right? And it's hard, it's been difficult to do simulations, cosmological n-body simulations with alternative behaviors. And this warm dark matter simulation is one of many from the past 15, 20 years, but the most sophisticated one to date. And I think more than anything, Carlos was sort of showcasing, here's some interesting issues with CDM, here's a state-of-the-art thing, and it's gotten a lot of press, which has been fantastic, but CDM isn't dead, warm dark matter isn't dead, there's a lot more stuff to do. I think in my talk and in others, we'll be talking about the different alternatives in terms of structure formation models, in terms of cosmological simulations. So we'll come back to things like your question.
A quick question.
The n-body simulation, if you just perturb your initial distribution function in phase space and then look at these perturbations, do you get the same streams? Can you get the same streams that you got from the n-body simulation? I mean, is it compatible with the perturbation, approach to the structures formation? If we take a distribution function and then perturb it?
Well, I think the you are in a CDM simulation, you are perturbing the phase space. That is, you perturb the positions of the particles and also the velocities by something like a Zeldovich approximation or perturbation theory. So you're perturbing the phase space structure, but in a way that just bends the phase space sheet. You're not adding any thickness to the phase space sheet. If you want to do warm dark matter, then you have to add velocity dispersion at the start, and that's actually very hard, and that's why these are tough simulations to do and do properly. As well, if you want to do the types of simulations that Diamond did, where they go to the bottom of the hierarchy, then you're putting in real velocity dispersion. You're actually simulating dark matter when it was hot, even if we're calling it cold dark matter. So you're always thinking about what happens in phase space in the initial conditions. In CDM, you essentially ignore velocity dispersion and just put ripples in the phase space sheet.
Well, we should probably move on. Let's thank Larry again.